on here. Hi, my name is Amanda. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Sorry, I just need to chill out for a second. I feel like I just moved this whole stage. My sobriety date is February 15th, 2010. My home group is Thank God I'm Sober, which is a women's group on Friday nights at 7 p.m. in Palmasia. And I have a sponsor, and I sponsor others. So to start with, I was born and raised in St. Petersburg, right across the bridge, in case you're not from here. Yeah, in the house. So I have mom and dad who are still married after 47 years. I have an older sister who's 9 years older than me. And kind of start off with, and this always tends to happen, because I pray before I speak, and it comes to me that I should always bring this up, because this is the first secret that I kept in my family, because a lot of how I learned how to keep secrets or hide things was kind of based, you know, in my family setting. My sister, like I said, is nine years older than me, and I guess I woke up one day, and I don't remember much from the age of, like, up until age six. I don't really recall having my sister in the house. I woke up one day and my mom said she wasn't there anymore. And I always wondered why. They said she was like a bad girl, like she wasn't behaving very well. And I found out later through the years, it's just like they just told me they took her to a young woman's residence, which was kind of like a place for girls who run away, and come find out later that my parents were telling me that she used to steal jewelry from my parents, and she tried to hurt me several times when I was little. She tried to throw me in a fireplace, I guess when I was a baby, and then the only instance that I really remember is I remember standing in our bathroom, and I was just tall enough, maybe not even tall enough to like see the bathroom counter, but she was holding my hand on an iron that was on. And I remember her trying to like fix it, but it was some really awful like old oatmeal lotion under the counter. And she put it all over my hands, which was burning, and my parents were just like fed up, and they're like, we have to, you know, get her out of the house. And I found out this stuff later, and it was just unusual. It was kind of like we didn't talk about my sister not being there, and we didn't talk about like where she was. I just kind of was supposed to act like I didn't have a sibling, and it was just really bizarre. So I kind of went all throughout like middle school and high school, and my sister would kind of like, when I guess she turned 18, I think I saw her at one point like a year later. She had a baby and got married in our backyard. My dad married them, and it was like a big hassle, and it was just always hush hush what happened with her. But our relationship, just for the rest of my story, is she'd come in and out of my life, and it was a very complicated relationship because I didn't really know how to relate to her, and she didn't really know how to relate to me. And I think that shaped a lot of female relationships that I went through, you know, growing up as well. So my parents were very codependent, and my dad worked for my grandfather at a car wash in Tampa here. It's next to Mons Venus, used to be what my grandfather owned. And my dad worked there for like 20 years, and it was like World War III in my house because my dad would come home and complain about my father, so my mom, and it was just like always a mess. So I just always tried to keep quiet and be good, because they were always talking about how bad my sister was. I was trying so hard to just be a good kid. And so I always was just like a bookworm, or just doing anything to stay out of trouble, just fly below the radar, and, you know, just trying to keep things even keel in the house. And so I always kind of felt like the peacemaker in the family. And so eventually my dad quit, and he opened his own business in St. Pete. And when they were building the business, it was just very hostile in the house between our families. And it just always felt like everything was on edge. Like, I really never felt settled. I never really kind of felt like I had a voice either. They'd go through things, and it was always about them. It was kind of like, I in my perspective at that age, I always kind of thought I was like an addendum, like just this extra thing they had to take care of because the business was a priority. And I just felt like I was kind of always having to survive, like just take care of myself. You know, I'm alone in this house and just always kind of on my own and always felt very alone. You know, and I had a lot of friends at school and I was involved in sports, but you know, like a lot of alcoholics will say in here, they felt very alone. I could have been around a lot of people and just felt very lonely. And eventually I get to high school, I'm still doing well in school. Popular on the outside, but felt super alone. I was like prom queen, I don't even know how that happened. And I just, you know, I just tried to, I stayed in my little bubble. My parents were very, very overprotective. And they eventually put like an alarm on our windows in our house, and so like there was no thought of ever like sneaking out. My dad was like frightening. But like, great dad, don't get me wrong, but he was just like scary. So my mom was like, I always talk about my parents as like my mom's the gas and my dad's the brake, you know. So like it was always that struggle of like my mom would be like, you're having a rough day, you have to take care of you, you have to do it, you know. My dad's like, no, you need to go harder and go stronger, it doesn't matter how you're feeling. So it was always just like gas break, and it was insane. And so I kind of just never knew. And you know, along with like keeping a family secret, like, you know, things would come up with family and they're like, you have a sister, you know, and that kind of stuff would come out and I would never know how to react to it. I'm like, yeah, I have a sister, but just kind of not really knowing what my identity was, I guess, you know, just growing up, not knowing really who I was, but other than a good student, you know, like I was a good student and I played sports and, you know, I stayed out of trouble. I didn't do any drugs or drink alcohol or anything in high school. In fact, I was vice president of SAD, which is utterly ironic today. So, you know, I was like in charge of prom promise, and my mom had been hit by a drunk driver when I was in high school. So I was like this adamant kid who wanted to read this like dreadful story and like encourage all the high school kids to not drink and drive, you know, at prom or at homecoming. And, you know, here I am like 20 years later, you know. So, you know, I think the theme of my life, like as you'll hear in a little bit too, is that I always kind of felt trapped. I always just felt very like, felt like I had no voice. I felt like I couldn't make a decision on my own. I'd fight with my parents about something that was, I thought, really benign at the time, and they would just say, you don't have an opinion. Like, we don't want to hear it. Whatever it is, it's worse than whatever you're going through. You know, there's always some kind of comparison. And so I get into college, and I went to Florida State. So, thank you, some Seminoles in the house. And I went crazy. So I get up there, I don't have anybody telling me what to do at all hours of the day, and the first time I drank, I remember sitting outside the dorm on the lawn because the fire alarm had gone off in our dorm, and I'm sitting on this beautiful lawn, I'm looking out, and I'm like, I don't care about anything. And it is awesome, you know, like just feeling free, like not caring about what's going on, how do I look, I don't care what people think, and it was just freeing. And so it continued, and I drank all throughout my time at Florida State. In fact, I almost failed out my first semester, and then I finally got my act together, but I still continued to drink. You know, I think my parents thought it was just more so like, it was the number one party school at the time, and so I just took full advantage of it. And I, you know, I didn't really have it, I didn't have consequences, but I take that back. A thought just came in my head. I had one night, it was my senior year, I went to some poetry reading thing for a class I was taking and drank a lot of wine there. And on my way back, I'm eating Doritos out of the bag while I'm driving back to my dorm or whatever, not my dorm, I was living in the sorority house, don't laugh at me. But so a car totally nails me in the side, and I knew I was drinking and I knew I would get in trouble, so the car took off. So I was like, I'll just pull into the parking lot over here and not call the police. My car is totally damaged, but I have to get it fixed because I can't even open the car door. I had to get out the passenger side, and I had to call my parents, and I totally lied to them that I wasn't drinking. And it didn't hit me until I was like 2 years sober that I completely left that out of my amends, and so that was the consequence I had, and I've been told by my sponsor not to bring that up right now. So I just, there's always a time and a place for things. So at that point in time, it wasn't good. But yeah, so I graduated from college, drank like a normal person, probably until, I don't know, I think, let me backtrack a little bit. I graduated from college. I had a boyfriend in college that was great. I had a boyfriend in high school that was awful. The boyfriend in college was awesome, but we were just young and just wasn't going to work out. He cheated on me, I cheated back at him, and it was just a mess, and a lot of it revolved around drinking. And then we broke up, and I was, my senior year, I was single, and then I get out of school, I move back to St. Pete, and I move in with my parents for a couple months, which was a nightmare. Like, back in the, you know, just very restricted home, and I could not wait to get out of there. And so I moved in with a friend, and I ended up meeting what turned out to be my husband later. And I drank normally throughout that time, but essentially my personality and who I was defined by my work. Like, I was defined just kind of like I was in middle school and high school, was being, you know, an overachiever in school. I did the same thing at work. I was kind of like, you know, just whatever it is, I put in whatever hours it was just to be on top. Like, I was in charge of this, I did that. Like, you know, I wanted to touch everything and say that I did it. Like, I needed that validation. And, you know, I worked my way through, I'm in marketing, so I've either worked for either an advertising agency or a corporate marketing firm for most of my career. And then the last place that I worked was, I don't want to go back that far, but I realized the boyfriend and I, sorry, I'm jumping around, but the boyfriend who later turned into my husband, we had been together for probably about 4 years, and then we got engaged. I was probably about 21, 22, and no, sorry, 25 we got engaged, because we started dating at 21, 22, and he was my drinking buddy. 100% everything that we did was revolved around drinking. So it's definitely like 5 to 7 days a week. You know, it didn't matter if we were working full time, but we were definitely, you know, on the same page when it came to drinking. And eventually we got engaged, and we got married. I was 26, and he was 26. We moved into a house, and I realized that's when I started like sneaking drinking. I would wait for my husband would fall asleep on the couch, and I would start kind of like drinking in the kitchen when he was napping, just to like calm down. I wasn't happy in my marriage, and I didn't realize that until even like 5 years after that. But I realized like it had started well before my disease progressed. So I didn't, it was interesting because a lot of my girlfriends told me that I wasn't the same around my husband that I was around my friends. Like, I was more myself around my girlfriends, but I was just never like said what I truly felt or like stood up for myself. I was very much a people pleaser and always trying to make everyone happy or like plateaued or like even around me. And just being the hero kid, and everything looked great on the outside. My husband and I moved into a new home. A bigger house, we put in a pool, like we had great jobs, we both worked, he had worked for an insurance company and I had worked for Allstate for about 3 or 4 years, and I was kind of like the superstar at work, you know, and I loved my job, and I felt like the only place I ever felt comfortable was at work and doing my job, and I felt like that's who I was, and I felt like I was very stable, capable, intelligent person, but I was all about, every time there was an award ceremony, I was like, you know, at work, if they were doing some kind of recognition, I was just like, they never recognized me for this, you know, I was like, I'm so amazing, why aren't they giving me awards, you know, it's just like that egotistical, and, you know, that, but I still worked really hard, I really wanted everybody to like me, and, but I did a great job at what I did, and I knew it, and things kind of got too ahead at work. in terms of like where I thought I wanted to go with my career. And my husband at the time was getting laid off from his insurance company, so we had just purchased this new home, so I said, why don't I try to get you a job at Allstate with me? And so I got him a job, not realizing how very incredibly unhappy I was at home, in my home life with him. It was just a very roommate kind of situation. Like, he paid the bills, I cleaned the house, you know, we were just passing the hallway, you know, and it was just very uncomfortable, not affectionate. He, you know, was not interested in talking about feelings or even communicating, and I stayed too long in something that was really unhealthy for me. And, like, I know that now. So my drinking was increasing at the same time. So he gets the job, he starts working with me, and he completely ignores me even more so at work than he did at home. He worked like five desks down from me. And then they approached me about us moving to Chicago together as a couple. And we had talked like maybe a couple weeks before this about like having kids. And we had been married about 5 years at that point, and we're having a beer in the pool. And I was like, what do you think about having kids? And he goes, oh God, not that again. And clearly he was not interested in having children. And, you know, then they approached us at work about us moving to Chicago, just the two of us. And then they were talking about promoting me at work. And it was all these things that I thought I wanted, was doing all this. And I crumbled. Like, I just fell apart in like a 2-day span. And, you know, it's like, I've heard a lot of people tell their story about how they wanted something so bad and they finally get there and they just either F it up or, you know, something happens and they make it, like, they make it a disaster. And I know that I certainly did that because I started drinking at work. And I was drinking Chardonnay out of my car at lunch, and I'm sending emails to people, totally trashed, with a lot of misspellings, and IMing people and hanging out at people's desks. Like, I just fell apart. Like, the depression came first. And, you know, for like, I remember there was probably a month where I couldn't come into work, where if somebody just looked at me, I couldn't stop crying. And at one point, they thought I had cerebral palsy. And my symptoms and my motor skills were so just messed up. Like, I couldn't write. I couldn't talk. I was stuttering when I talked. I couldn't pick up my leg to walk over a curb without picking up my leg. Like, the depression came out in such a crazy physical way that, I mean, they literally thought I had cerebral palsy. And so I went and got tested, and they're like, no, your anxiety is out of control. So what comes next? Drinking. So I start drinking to calm myself, and it just gets worse. And like I said, I'm doing this at work, and I get caught a few times, and I don't learn my lesson. My ex-husband, well, sorry, of course you're going to find that out eventually, but but my husband just kept getting further and further away. He was more embarrassed of me. He looked at me as a liability, which he had every right to think that. I was definitely not easy to live with. And it just got more serious, and I eventually, I took a leave of absence from work for about 3 months, and then I came back, and you know, I thought I was together, and then I started drinking at the IOP, and I just could not stay sober for even an hour. And, you know, that was when my body was to the point where I couldn't take in food. I got Baker acted, not for 36 hours, but for 2 weeks. And I was on the cardiac floor for a week, and I had, apparently I came in with a 0.48 blood alcohol. And I say that because 0.4 is clinically dead, and 0.48, I should have been really dead. And I am definitely a miracle because I got through that part, but I kept telling everybody what I thought they wanted to hear. It was, I'm going to go to AA meetings. I'm going to do this, you know, and the second I get out, within like 3 days, I'm drinking again. You know, after being in the hospital for, you know, I was on suicide watch. I had charcoal. This little nurse that was like an angel was just sitting there staring at me when I woke up the next day. And she's like, you almost died last night. And I was like, what are you talking about? And she's like, no. She's like, everyone here thought you were going to die. Like, your mom was planning your funeral. And it still didn't hit me. Like, I was just still in alcohol mood. So after that, that was in October 2009. It got worse. I don't remember much of October, November, December, embarrassing myself over the holidays at my parents' Christmas party, another overdose in January. My husband filed for divorce when I was staying at my parents' house the first week in January. Just drinking myself to craziness at my parents' house, sneaking it. Had a really embarrassing episode at Slime Mart with my mom one day. Don't recall much of it. Involved a water bottle and a lot of alcohol. and my niece worked there at the time, so that was pretty awesome. And so eventually it becomes February, and I am marching enacted by the state. And I ended up at HCC. And Community College, but Healthcare Connection. So that was my home. My husband and I completely walked away. I just knew that we were getting divorced. Like I said, everything was pretty much a blur, and if it wasn't for my parents making sure that I was, like, locked up somewhere, I would not be here today. And I definitely was the person that needed to be locked away from it, and I'm very grateful I didn't have to go to jail for that I got to go to a treatment facility. And it took me a really long time to figure out that I was super codependent, that I was definitely an alcoholic. It took a long time for me to come out of my fog, and there are a couple people in this room that saw me when I was there, and I'm definitely a different person today. She came up to me a year later, and she's like, "You're not as angry as you used to be." I'm like, "Thanks." So, it took me about 3 months just to have the cloud lifted, and it took me a long time to stop lying. I did not know how to tell the truth or tell anybody what I really thought without worrying about what they were thinking. And I didn't know I could say my thoughts out loud, and I really wasn't able to emote. You know, like, I basically wasn't allowed to cry, wasn't allowed to be angry. I didn't know how to be angry until probably a couple of years into being sober. I didn't know how to be angry without, like, killing someone or, like, completely holding it in and then losing my crap on somebody, you know? And I didn't know those emotions. And so when I got there, I met this incredible guy that was in the Men's Village who was a heroin addict, and he was my next husband, 100%. So I kept this long love affair of note writing with him for about 6 months. When I was at HCC, I'd leave him notes under mats, and I'd find ways to call him from the payphone, and he was the love of my life. And I'm not even divorced yet, right? So, and I haven't seen my husband. I don't even know where he is. And I went through my divorce treatment, still talking to this guy about how we're going to get married right after I'm divorced. I mean, I was just out of my mind. So, you know, you can be a little cloudy when you're first coming out of it. But at 6 months, I went through my actual divorce proceedings with lawyers. 6 months sober. I wouldn't recommend that to anyone, because I didn't have the clarity to think I should have had an adult who was sober with me at the time, other than a lawyer. So I ended up staying in treatment for another 3 months before I kept moving up a phase, and then they find out I was lying and talking to this guy, and I get knocked back down. I do really great, and then they find out I kissed him somewhere, and then I get knocked back down. And then I'd get, you know, really far up, about to, like, go into three quarters, and then I would completely just get, like, bashed back to the first phase of treatment. And my parents were like, "What is wrong with you? Like, we're paying a lot of money." And I was like, "I don't know." You know, I was just... Finally, one day, I got so tired of lying, and really, that was the one thing that was holding me back, was just lying and not just being honest about, like, I want to feel this feeling, you know? And I did everything wrong in treatment except for drink or use. Like, it's weird. I mean, they caught me after something, like, "You didn't drink or do drugs?" And I was like, "No, I know I can't do that." But I was breaking every other rule, which is ridiculous. So finally, I got tired of it. The pain was great enough, and I came in and I just spilled the beans. And I was just like, "I can't do this anymore. It's too painful." And that's when I turned the corner. And they're like, in 3 weeks, we want you to move out into your own apartment. So I'm like, I'm not ready for that. I was like, now I feel safe here. But eventually I got an apartment, lived in my first place on my own. I didn't go back to marketing. Allstate offered me a job back, and after talking to my aftercare group about it, I opted not to go back because I drank a lot there, and my ex-husband still worked there. And it was freeing and really cool to feel like I could be my own person, because I had worked the steps with my sponsor while I was in treatment. You know, I was there for 8 months, so I took my time. And I learned so much about myself, and I really gained, I gained more self-worth. I mean, I came in, my mom told me that years before my drinking got out of hand, that I was like this bright flower. And when I started drinking, and when I got to treatment, when I was finally Marchman acted and locked up, that I was just this wilted flower. And by the time I was out on my own, and I felt like a new person. So I decided to go back to school for ultrasound. I took a wide right turn from marketing and everything that I'd ever done in my professional career. And I went to ultrasound school for 2 years. And I loved every minute of it. It's the first time I hadn't worked full time since I was like 14 or 15. I know it was a very different experience. And then I graduated. I was really proud of it. And then I went to take my boards. And, you know, not everything is perfect in sobriety. I didn't pass my boards. I missed it by 10 points. And then I went to take it again. And I was going through something difficult with my mom, which I didn't mention. My mom is an active alcoholic, and she's progressing. I'm going to start crying every time I bring that up. I had to stop talking to her for a few months when that happened, and because her drinking made me want to drink. And you would think it would have the opposite effect, but watching your mom deteriorate, I felt like I needed an escape. And luckily, I had the tools and resources not to do that. But so while that was happening, I wasn't quite focused on my exam, so I missed it again by 10 points. So after being unemployed for a while, which was probably the most devastating part of my sobriety, I went almost 9 months without a job. And it was incredibly difficult because I felt really worthless. After I just built up all this self-esteem and self-worth, I felt like, here I am again, I don't have a purpose, you know. But luckily, I was immersing myself in the program. I was going to 2 meetings a day, I was speaking at detoxes, I was sponsoring, I did everything I could. That was the only social interaction I had during the day, and I can tell you numerous times I went to the Nunyana and I would just go in bawling because I didn't know how to cope, but I knew to go there, you know. And I think it's important to share this, that there was a point in my sobriety probably about a year ago that one night I went to bed, and it was just so depressing because I kept applying for jobs, doing everything possible, and I kept asking for God's will, and I just felt like, what am I supposed to be doing, you know? I'm doing everything I'm being taught to do, and I went to bed one night, and I didn't want to wake up. It was the first time I ever felt like I wanted to die in sobriety. And I know that's really heavy, but I share that because I didn't drink. And I didn't want to drink, and I didn't want to use, but it was the scariest time in my sobriety. I really felt lost and hopeless, and I went and hung out with my family all day, and I couldn't be by myself. It was a really frightening time. In fact, it reminded me from how I felt prior to how I would calm myself with drinking, you know, because that was the only escape I had, was to drink, to just, like, forget what was going on. And it was a struggle. I could not be by myself. I'd lived by myself for 4 years, yet I could not be alone. And even when I was with people, I was frightened about when I had to go home again. It was kind of like how I was obsessed with drinking and how I was going to get the next drink. It was kind of like, I'm scared to death to go home. But reaching out to the women in the program, making sure that I told people where I was at and how I was feeling, and asking them to come pick me up because I just couldn't drive myself anywhere. I couldn't leave my apartment, or, you know, I was deathly afraid to be there by myself, but I was afraid to be around people. I didn't want people to see me be a mess all the time. I'm like, this isn't what you're supposed to look like in sobriety. But that's not the truth. You know, everybody has feelings. Like, not everything is perfect when you get sober. But it's so much easier when you're sober. Because I can make a complete sentence, and I'm not falling asleep, and I'm not drinking and driving, and I could at least tell people how I'm feeling. The fact that I'm aware of what my feelings are today is amazing. Like, I can wake up today. I mean, I remember sitting in treatment being like, I don't know how I feel. It's really scary to not know that. So I reached out to women in the program. I went to a lot of meetings. And like I said, the fellowship has been there for me. You know, amazing. I mean, this is a family that I can count on when I can't count on my real family. And I do feel at home here, and I feel at peace every time I come to a meeting, because it is just, it's the only place where I feel understood. And anytime anybody's ever told me something that they've gone through, or every time I've done a fourth step with someone, or when I did mine with my sponsor, and like learning how to trust women again, and how to trust people in general, and how to trust myself, has been the most amazing part of this journey for me. And so after that happened, I did eventually get a job. And I like to throw this in there because my parents own a car wash in St. Pete. And prior to getting sober, I would have been too proud to work there. But I really needed a job. And I'm the type of personality that needs to be around people in order to like get energy. You know, so my parents were like, we need a cashier. And I was like, oh, God, I can't go back to my hometown where I got divorced and see all these people that come in here. And I was like, God forbid, you know. And I was like, need a job. I need to be around people and I need to make money. It was the happiest I've been in a long time. So working with my family, seeing people all day, feeling like I had a purpose, it took me those 3 months to get a full-time job while I was working there. And my parents were grateful that I was happier, that I didn't want to die. And, you know, I eventually got a full-time job, and things worked out. And I made sure, because I did have all that full-time, I had all that time to dedicate to my program, that I was going to be missing a lot of that working full-time. So I finally got into general service. So I'm an alternate GSR for my home group, and hopefully will be the GSR next month. I've been really excited about keeping myself in the center of the boat and going to district meetings and, you know, just trying to get more involved and learning about general service. I have a service sponsor, and there's so many things to learn. I understand when people with a lot of time say that I'm still learning something, you know, that far into sobriety, like, it totally makes sense to me. I'll be 5 years in February, and I'm like, everything feels brand new to me still, you know, and it's just really cool to feel that way. You know, like I said, I've been involved with that, and I feel very grateful to have two sponsees. One of them's here tonight, and she's very, very dear to me, and I think God puts people in your life for a reason. And it's kind of funny because her birthday is my sobriety date, so it was like a little God moment. But, you know, every part of this program and everyone I go to, like, definitely emotional. Been going to Al-Anon, too, so that kind of brings up stuff, so I'm just like a crying mess. So that's just me. That's where I'm at. I'm not going to apologize for it. I used to apologize for my feelings, and I don't do that anymore. I feel like it's a gift to get this program. I feel honored and privileged to be asked to speak here. I really needed this service work tonight, and I'm grateful to Amanda for asking me. And thank you all for being a part of my journey, because I know a lot of people in here. And, you know, get to know each other. Don't be afraid to be who you are if you're new, and let people get to know you, because that's how you build these relationships, and that's how you learn to love each other and be there for each other. Because if I hadn't done that, because I kind of hid out for the first 2 years of my sobriety, and I didn't know I could let people know who I was. So know, I just felt inclined to say that. I guess God was tapping me to say that. But thank you so much for letting me speak here tonight. I'm going to finish a few minutes early because I think that's about it for me. Thanks.